This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show number 185. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can call us on
02088 167691.
And you can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
My name's David Hinchliffe, and this week I'm joined by Mark Garraway and Berners. Well, it's back to business as usual on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Welcome to the show, Berners. Welcome to the show, Garraz.
All right, Coach, how are you?
Yes, good. Well rested after my my week off, having nothing to do with cricket for a little while, which is always refreshing. But I'm back in action now, and everything's on course for a really exciting next few months as we go from summer in the north to summer in the south of the world.
Yes, the grade cricket season will be rocking in Australia, and in India they play every single day of the year.
Yeah, rain or shine, it's always cricket season in India, isn't it? So yeah, there's not so much a season as just cricket. What have you been up to, Garraz?
I went to an ECB conference for elite coaches last week up at the new FA headquarters, the Academy, up in Burton, which was absolutely fantastic. And it was all about challenging conventions and the usual beliefs of how cricket should be played and how it should be coached. And it was very, very interesting indeed.
Really? Okay. And what's that facility like?
It's you can imagine it's got everything that you could ever want within what is quite a large space. And I think they've positioned it very well because it is in the middle of nowhere, effectively. And they've got huge amounts of green space, loads of pitches, a magnificent sports science and particularly sports medicine centre, which is the envy of the world. And it's very, very well run. I think David Sheepshanks, who is his legacy, really, piece putting that in. I think he's done a magnificent job, and now it's all about getting the right people around that bricks, mortar and grass to make it all work.
Just by the way, if you hear lots of banging and crashing going on in the background, it's because here at Pitch Vision Towers, we're adding a west wing to the mansion. Underneath that is going to be the bat cave. And that's going to be a magnificent facility as well. So if you hear any unusual noises in the background, that's what's going on there. I'll try and mute things when I'm not talking.
I've heard it's my holding area.
Is it the staging area?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. I don't even know what that's for. I don't want to go into it. But yeah, we're talking about challenging conventions and things like that this week. Last week, I should say, on the show, on the Pitch Vision Academy website, we had a video from Ian Pont talking about his way of coaching the bowling action. So, Garraz, I wanted to catch up with your thoughts on what you do when you're dealing with coaching the bowling action to younger players who need to learn it from scratch.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're dealing with younger players, particularly really young ones, I think the best thing to do is get them to copy, because one of the abilities we have as a child is the ability to copy and mimic. And what they often do is they copy and mimic people, but then put it in the style that their body is best used to. The temptation as a coach is to try and coach them out of that and to get them to work within our preferences as a coach rather than their body's preference. So certainly over the years, I've encouraged people. I've shown them, you know, the basic bowling action of somebody in elite sport, elite cricket, doing it, and get them to follow their own body's path within that framework of somebody else at the elite level bowling, and they find their own way generally. So when we're dealing with the younger ones, that's pretty much what I do to start off with, and then it's about fine tuning it rather than trying to make every bowler exactly the same look, depending on whatever that model is in my head.
I quite like Ian's approach to it, where he has a number of points in his head which he's looking for, but he also knows that different people adapt to different things. And you can still, for example, in his case, we're talking about fast bowling, you can still bowl quick if you don't have every single one of those key points nailed down completely. So if someone isn't, for example, the lock front leg, which he talks about, some very quick bowlers don't have that locked front leg, and it's not necessary to have it. It's just preferable to have it. So it's nice to see that even when you're talking about something like coaching the bowling action, which traditionally has been do it this one way or two or three ways, it's a lot more flexible than it used to be even sort of 5 years ago.
Yeah, and that's what happens when we get an understanding, isn't it? We understand the body better. We understand through various people's PhDs. And I was with Kevin Shine last week. He was part of this convention. He delivered a magnificent coaching presentation on what he's found out in the characteristics of fast bowling. And in line with Ian Pont, he says, you know, as long as most of these things are in place and some of them have more priority than others, then you've got a good chance of being able to deliver balls at 90 plus miles an hour. But they don't all have to be in there for that to happen. But, you know, a number of them do need to be in there. So a braced front leg being one of his things that you should look out for as being really, really important. But if it's not in there, it's not completely the end of the world as long as there's enough of the other stuff in there.
Yeah, exactly. And as long as you're not doing anything which is dangerous, then you can get away with there's so many different styles of bowling, and you see such a wide variation, but yet you see players capable of producing pace in lots of different ways. So maybe it's not a matter of producing textbook or what used to be called textbook perfect bowlers, but bowlers who are perfect within their own textbook. That seems to be a big drive at the moment towards modern coaching.
Yeah, it certainly is, and that was what was a major part of our conference last week was around that, and it's something that we've done at school quite significantly over the last couple of months, is to profile people's learning and their motor profiles, so everything that we do now is in line with their motor profiles rather than us just saying, right, you need to get your head leading into the front foot shot because that's the way it has to be done. And a lot of coaches find that difficult to have that flexibility around it, because we've always been taught that when you play forward, you lead with your shoulder and your head. Yet it's pretty obvious from watching the normal game of cricket now that some of the top performers in the world don't actually do that. And quite a few of the kids that we've got that are playing certainly won't be doing that because it doesn't fit in with the way that they normally move.
Okay, well, we're going to move on quickly today because we've got an interview coming up after the yes-no round, and that's our intrepid reporter, Martin Gleeson of Cricket India Academy, has been out and about again, getting more information from coaches while he's been setting up Cricket India Academies all over the country. So that's exciting. We'll catch up with that after the yes-no round, which of course every week is the chance for us to say just yes or no to three statements that Berners comes up with. So Berners, you've got the questions this week. We can only say yes or no, Gareth and I. So over to you for this week's round.
Okay, the first question, the Yorker is the most effective ball to bowl.
No.
No.
Second question, Usain Bolt will be an entertaining addition to the Big Bash League.
Yes.
Yes.
Question three, India will thrash England in an ODI series.
No.
Yes.
Dr. Stephen Rin joins me now. Stephen is a lecturer at University of Queensland in sports coaching, holds a doctorate in coach learning, and currently works at the elite level of Australian cricket in terms of the coaches, working with such guys as Rod Marsh, Level 3 Coach Education Program, and the Centre of Excellence Coaches. Stephen, welcome to India, your first trip. What have been your thoughts?
Yeah, it is my first trip over this way. Travelled extensively throughout other parts of the world, but first time over in this part of Asia. On a personal side of things, it's been quite an interesting visit in terms of the sights that we've seen, the Amber Fort and places around Jaipur. Food-wise, culinary experience has been quite different to what I'd normally have at home. So that's been interesting and exciting at every meal. But also professionally, it's been an interesting thing working with Australian coaches from all parts of the country, but also obviously the Indian coaches and the support staff that are on the ground here.
Your role has primarily been to facilitate and manage the education component of the coach induction program this week. How has your role been different to what you do within the Australian system?
The Australian system, it is more of a system. It's a nationwide program or set of programs. So my involvement has typically been probably with the high performance level of coaches. Here it's a little bit different. So there's a very good system within the Cricket India Academy and the cricket education program and a system of developing coaches, but it's not nationwide. So it's not the kind of thing that most of the coaches in the course have any experience with before. So in terms of how it's different, from my perspective, the facilitation is about setting some expectations about what they're going to get and what they're required to do within a program like this. More so in Australia, it's about focusing specifically on the content and the needs of the coaches who have already got established needs and wants and desires and know the system a little bit more. So it's a little bit of a change over this part of the world.
The observation of Indian coaches, I guess the two parts are similarities with the Australian coaches and also the differences in the way that they operate.
I'll start with the differences because as a first arriving here, the differences are the things that are most obvious, I guess. And to start with, my impression has been that the technical understanding of Indian coaches is second to none. They're master tacticians or technicians to do with the disciplines of batting and bowling in particular. But having worked with the coaches over the period of the week now, there's actually probably far more similarities than differences between the two groups of coaches. They're really driven towards athlete performance, but beyond that, it's about developing the whole person and a view that cricket can be one part of an overall cricketer's life, and it's important to consider their place in and the place of cricket in their lives. So there's this overwhelming desire to help the individuals that they're working with, and I think that's common between Australia and India for sure.
A program such as this, for a coach education program, for cricket education program in affiliation with Cricket Australia, how does this fit in with the overall development of a coach?
There's actually a lot of research about out in the field now about informal and formal learning. So traditionally the debate was which is better, formal learning in places like coach induction processes like this or coach accreditation and certification courses, as well as tertiary study and programs like that that I teach in at the University of Queensland, whether or not they're better or worse than informal opportunities, things like learning from experience and trial and error, learning and interacting with other coaches or learning from the coaches that you had as an athlete. And the research evidence is actually showing that they're not necessarily better or worse than each other. They actually can be, when operating at optimal levels, they're complementary. And so that periodically you can engage with tertiary study or periodically you can engage with coach accreditation and certification, that should be a stimulus or a catalyst for some of your change and your ongoing development. But the best coaches are learners as well. They consider themselves to be learners as well as their athletes. So being able to learn from your own experiences, learn from the coaches around you and learn from your past experiences is really important. And it's the key difference. Experience as a coach is a necessary but not sufficient criteria for being a good coach. Just because you've got experience doesn't mean you're great. And reflection and being a reflective coach is a big part of that. So it really is the difference between a coach who's had 10 years of experience in which they've changed and modified their practice each year based on their reflections and their ongoing desire for change versus a coach who's done the exact same thing for 10 years repeatedly.
So that then leads to, in an 8-day program like this, how much change do you think you can affect in these coaches?
It obviously depends on the coach themselves and how receptive they are to change. So In terms of its overall impact, it could be seen as a relatively small or low level of impact, because 8 days versus, you know, the other hundreds of days in the year versus also the number of years experience that you've had, you could see it, you could probably guess that it was a low impact endeavor. But the coaches that we've been working with this week in particular, their receptivity to the material that we're providing and all those kinds of things means that despite its short duration, it can actually have a massive impact. And from the start of the course to the end of the course, the changes that we've observed in our coaches has been actually quite significant. And of course, the challenge then is to see if you can maintain that. And when they go back to their home environments, do they revert back to what they've previously done or what they've seen other coaches do? Or do they do it in the way that we've suggested is going to be more conducive in the long run?
And from your perspective, then that leads to, from a personal perspective, how has this experience enriched your coach education, and what changes will you take back into the Australia?
Yeah, I mean, we at the university we've had have a lot of international students, but they predominantly come from the UK and North America, and so we've got increasing numbers of people who are interested in the programs back home from regions like Taiwan, China, India. So I think it's given me a bit of a taste for the caliber of people who might be interested in working with us at the university. And also, I mean, cricket is such a great language to speak between Australia and in India. So those are the kinds of things that I'm certainly taking out of my experience here.
Great. Any messages for the coaches out there on how they can facilitate their own development?
I guess it's linked with that notion of formal and informal learning. If you can seek out opportunities and develop yourself and better your coaching through a number of those different opportunities, that's going to lead to the best outcomes for you as a coach, but also for your athletes. And ultimately, that's the group we're trying to affect.
All right, so we're back in the Pitch Vision Studios for this week's question section. The mailbag is open. Berners is rummaging around inside. And, of course, every week we pick two questions, and the best question of the week wins a prize, which is an online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And if you're listening and if you sent in your question, you'll be waiting with bated breath to see if you're the one this week to be answered. So, Berners, what have you got for us?
First question comes in from Wolf, and I really like this question, actually. It's he's come in, he's dear Pitch Visioners, he likes the community, and he's just saying that quite often it's often talked about batting partnerships, and it's a topic of conversation, but never really bowl partnerships, for example, when, how, and why they work. And he's just asking if we can plan a strategy and roles in different formats, and if there are any examples of how this has worked, what are they?
Well, I think the classic one, which we talked about a lot on Pitch Vision Academy, is when you're thinking about bowling in partnerships, then you don't necessarily think about just what's happening with you. So, you know, your classic one is you've got the miserly seamer at one end who takes, you know, 1 for 36 off his 10 overs. And then you've got the leg spinner at the other end who maybe goes for fives, but he also takes 4 or 5 wickets. And between the two of them, they form a pretty destructive partnership. So that's your classic partnership. But it is something that I think a lot of captains at club level don't think about a lot.
Well, I think they think about it, but they don't know how to substantiate it. I think probably different, because we all know that certain people bowl well with certain people, don't we? But we don't know why it works, or we don't know how effective it is. We just know that it works. One of the things that came out of this convention last week sort of is related to it. Individual bowlers that obviously then make up a partnership, because you bowl the game from both ends, are more likely to get a wicket in their first two overs than they are as their spell goes on, which I thought was quite interesting. Now, that doesn't mean to say that after two overs you take somebody off and you bring somebody else on, but it is an interesting one when a captain is there thinking, oh, we're going all right here, we built some pressure up. And then that pressure keeps going, but actually a wicket doesn't fall. Is there the option to swap it and change it, even if it is only for two or three overs, and then bring the other guy back on. And obviously, if you've got a super spinner that's really consistent, you've got the opportunity of bringing that person back on and him not going for any runs again. And we see that in all formats of the cricket. So sort of counter that, not counter, I suppose, to support the partnership argument is, you know, do sometimes we leave bowlers bowling in partnership for too long when actually we could be introducing another bowler alongside one of them who can come in and nip a wicket out and then we can change it again. And I don't see enough of that happening in junior cricket and in club cricket.
OK, so what are the some of the common partnerships that you see working? I've talked about the medium pacer who keeps it tight against the classic leg spinner who bowls perhaps a little bit less accuracy but gives it a big rip and they go for a few more runs per over, but they're more likely to take wickets. What other partnerships do you see that work well together?
I think as the game moves on now, you're looking at and particularly with 2020, you're looking at your one over bowlers, aren't you? Your one and two over bowlers that can come in and add something to a partnership. So thinking back to when Rajasthan Royals won their title in IPL 1, you had Warne bowling in those middle overs and he'd bowl his four straight through. But then you'd get somebody like Tanveer or Watson would come on and bowl an over and often get a wicket. So it's a mini partnership, but it is a partnership in itself as well. So, it's horses for courses in terms of formats. But I think that sometimes we can extend our thinking across formats to chop and change it a little bit.
And it helps with bringing players on if you think about bowling players in partnerships as well. If you've got a young player who's perhaps not that confident at the level that you're playing and you've got a more experienced player who can bowl at the other end and give you a bit more of that control, then that takes a little bit of the pressure off the less experienced player, I think. That's a good combination to have as well, isn't it?
I agree. I think that's a really valid point and something that we rarely see in club cricket, but certainly I saw it at my club because that was very much part of the mantra there was to bring on the youngsters. And so Danny Briggs would be bowling alongside a guy called Andy White who bowled for donkey's years and probably still does actually, as much as his body allows him. And it allowed Danny to learn his game at the other end without the game getting taken away from the team on any given day.
When you're bowling burners, who do you like at the other end?
Preferably no one.
No one at all? You've got to have someone.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I bowl my left arm orthodox, I like bowling to a right-hander because I come round the wicket and go through the umpire, and then I find that if I've got a bowl straighter and I come over the wicket to a left-hander, I can't put it in the right place and I get the yips. But it often helps with someone at the other end that's tied them down and they normally go for broke. Typical club amateur cricket style, you know, if the pressure builds up at one end and you can almost plot it and plan it for certain key times of the game. I also find the nice waist-high full toss goes down quite well as well normally, third or fourth ball and they drill it straight down deep square's throat. But definitely wouldn't want me bowling at both ends, I know that.
Got some record scores in the offing.
The run rate would keep ticking. It's ticking over nicely.
What's the next question?
Next question is from Cups, and he plays for both his club and his school, and he's saying that big problem for him at the moment is he gets very angry whilst bowling. He's a bit of a hose pipe. He likes to spray it around a bit, and he's saying that it causes him a lot of hatred and anger. Good old fast bowler, scratching his head and blowing his cheeks in and out, I can imagine, and he's just saying that his coaches have told him that he's a normal fast bowler and that's why he gets agitated. He likes to run in and try and wang it down. The only problem being, of course, is that when it gets to this stage, the captain tends to pull the plug and that's the end of Cups' game. So he's just asking what he can do when he hits chaos theory and doesn't know what to do anymore. How can he stay calm and carry on with his spell?
My view is that you need to have passion to bowl fast and you just need to learn to manage yourself. And it's something that you shouldn't expect a 9, 10 or 13-year-old to be able to do, particularly, is to be able to control himself. And you look at somebody like Jimmy Anderson, who's regarded to be one of the best, if not the best in the world at the moment. It's only the last 4 years that he's really controlled himself and managed himself properly. So stick with kids. You know, if they do blow a gasket, like it sounds like Cups do, stick with them as coaches. Obviously, you want them to play within the spirit of the game, but you want to try and shift their behaviours and their understanding so they can actually use this passion as a positive thing rather than just getting agitated, bowling rubbish, and then the captain having to take them off. The way to do it, centering is a really good way of doing it, and that's by using your breathing. And what we tend to do is when we get agitated, whether it be at cricket or anything else in life, we tend to get very quick with our breathing and not taking appropriate oxygen into our body. So use your belly, do some belly breathing rather than breathing through the chest. Make your belly big and full of air. Do that a few times and you'll find that a calm starts to come over you and you start to control yourself a little bit as well. And finally, smile. Okay, because if we smile, often that the muscles and the nerve endings that are in our face then have a way of transcending that positive energy back down into the body, and we feel under control a bit. And it's always been a lesson that I've tried to teach my fast bowlers that I've had that are passionate is a smile actually helps to suppress some of those angers and agitations that sit within us that often make us not perform at our best.
Also, from a batting perspective, there's nothing more annoying than a smiling, leaping, bounding bowler coming at you. Even when you hit him for four or something happens, if he's smiling and laughing, you can't but help to want to either run up and whack him with your bat or stick the next one over the fence as well. And I can guarantee if he's bowling to me, he will win. A smiling bowler will win because eventually I'll just hit chaos and I'll probably just don't want to even play cricket again. How dare you smile at me? You're not having a good time.
You play a beautiful cover drive for four and he just stands there smiling.
Yeah.
As if it's all part of his master plan.
That is the most frustrating thing in the world. Or just to not actually acknowledge the fact that you've just hit him through, like, you know, you could call it arrogance or mere swagger to just go, okay, that doesn't bother me. I'm still fine. When really, he's probably absolutely burning up inside, but just... You know, if you see him head on hands and screaming at you, great, that's 1-0 to me. Thank you very much. He's lost the plot.
Just to extend what Gareth is saying there as well about experimenting with what works for you and trying to find the things that are most effective, and that does take time. One of the ways that you can think about that is working out exactly what it is that is causing you the stress in that moment. Because some people... there are different types of people that react to stress in different ways, and sometimes there's some type of people who get stressed. They're in an environment which is a pressure environment, like when you're bowling in an important cricket match, and you get the stress response first. So you get your heart rate goes up, or you get sweaty palms, or whatever it is that you're. Physical stress responses, you get that first and that stresses you out even more. And then for other people, it's more to do with their thoughts first, and then that causes the stress response. So it's a good thing to work out what it is exactly that's happening first when you do start to get stressed out, because then you can plan out what you're going to do when you start feeling that stressful situation, whether it's controlling your breathing, which works for people who tend to get the physical reaction first, or whether it's having some kind of a mental trick, like using the stop technique, for example, which we talk about a lot on the show, where you tell yourself, you use a red traffic light and say stop, and then you think a positive thought instead, because that works more effectively with people who have the thought before the physical reaction. So I think the message is, we've got some practical things in there, but the message really is there isn't a shortcut to it. You have to try different things until you find the thing that works for you, because everyone has a very different way of doing it.
Here's a part of the show. David's going to get up on the soapbox. He's going to have a little rant and rave for a minute. And I should imagine, knowing David, that he'll finish precisely on 60 seconds.
Well, it's my claim to fame that I always manage to do 60 seconds. So this week I'm going to talk about something which has confused me slightly, which is man caddying, which is the process of running a non-striking batsman out if he goes out of his ground as the bowler goes to deliver the ball, which is legal. There's a technicality around it, but you can do it legally. And growing up as I did in the southeast of England, where it's frowned upon, I always... was very confused by it, because I think that the batsman is, if the batsman's doing it, then he's doing it to try and gain an unfair advantage. And as I come from good Yorkshire stock originally, there's no qualms in running a batsman out who goes out of his ground more than once. And in fact, my dad said to me once that he didn't even give people the one chance, which is traditional. So don't get so het up about mancadding. It's cheating, but it's cheating by the batsman, not by the bowler. That is the end of the show for this week. Before we go, we are going to finish up with our traditional style of picking a competition winner from the two questions. The best one wins the prize of the online coaching course from PitchVision Academy at pitchvision.com. So, Gareth, which one did you prefer?
Well, you know that sometimes I'm swayed by a name, but these are two equally good names, I think, that we've got this week, and two equally good questions, although I have to say that I think, talking about challenging convention as we have done in the show, that Wolf's question really challenged us and got us to think about different ways that partnerships could be formulated, which was excellent. So Wolf wins it this week because the question challenged us, and also my nickname at Hampshire was Wolf as well. So sorry, Cups, you didn't really stand a chance there.
Wolf was your nickname at Hampshire?
It certainly was. And when before I turned 20, I was Team Wolf, and then just Wolf.
That's phenomenal.
Team Wolf.
Team Wolf.
Oh, brilliant. Right, okay. Berners, if someone wanted to send in a question to the show and have their chance of winning a prize and, of course, get the question answered, how would they do that?
Well, even Wolf's got a phone, so it's 020-88-167-691 on the phone, or they can drop us an email, and it's coach@pitchvision.com.
It is. Our Twitter is @PBCricketCoach. Our Facebook is facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. If you want to subscribe to the show, you can do so in iTunes by doing a search for Pitch Vision Academy, or you can head over to pitchvision.com/academy, click on the podcast link, and all the details for subscribing to the RSS feed are in there if you know what that's all about. We've already had a tail ender in a way this week, Berners. What was it? Hose pipe when the bowler sprays?
Hose pipe.
Yeah. That's good. I like that. I thought as well, I was trying to think of moments in cricket matches which haven't got names yet, and I was thinking back to a game I played this year when I accidentally was in the changing room when someone who was having a pretty bad season with the bat walked in. I hadn't even seen how he got out. So perhaps you need a name for that, where it's slightly awkward. You don't really know what to say to them. You can't really say bad luck. For all you know, they swiped across a straight one. So what do you say to that person when they walk in, and do we need a name for that awkward situation?
That is an awkward situation. I normally say, do you play football in the winter?
Yeah, consider changing sports. It might be better in the long run.
Yeah. Or what does your wife or girlfriend normally do on a Saturday afternoon that you could potentially accompany her with or do?
Well, if anyone's getting any suggestions for a name for that moment, then it's coach@pitchvision.com. That's all for this week. So until next time, cheers, Berners. Cheers, Team Wolf.
Cheers, guys.
I was thinking about howling, but I bailed.